This turns out to not be one of those years in which we get snow in the mountains 2 weeks before Halloween. That is, in fact, today, 2 weeks before Halloween. But winter is coming. The cold weather will arrive sooner or later. So if we haven't fired up our furnaces yet, we certainly will before long. And that starts another winter ritual, watching the energy bills so we don't go broke staying warm. It's not unusual for energy prices to climb a bit coming into the winter. This year is no different. But perhaps it's somewhat less than you might have thought. Let's talk about energy use and availability and cost in this hour. Our guest is Chris McGill, who's the Vice President of Policy Analysis at the American Gas Association. He has been our guest before. We talked about a very similar topic about this time a year ago. Chris, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, glad to be here, Jeffrey. And I am also sitting in a windowless room, but I have my motorcycle parked outside, which I hope to ride home on a 70-degree sunny day today. So,
and this is in Washington, D.C., I'm guessing?
Yes, in Washington, D.C. So I listened to your weather forecast, and there was a lot of rain in it. But you're right. The winter heating season is coming upon us. Your observation about costs associated with natural gas to heat your home is correct also. Those costs are up a little bit this year as local gas utilities put natural gas into storage and prepared to put the supplies together so that customers would be served. But again, as usual, the temperatures, the weather in general, will have a big impact on winter heating season bills this year on the West Coast and in the Pacific Northwest. The last weather forecast I looked at from the National Weather Service pointed to the period August through December and then January through March as potentially having above average temperatures anyway for that period. So we'll just have to see what works out.
Tell us a little bit about the American Gas Association itself, how long it's been around and what it does.
Yeah, AGA is a representative group for local gas utilities. We're located in Washington, D.C. All of the investor-owned, the large utilities in the country, are members of the American Gas Association. We have interests here representing the companies in Washington, of course, associated with regulatory and legislative items. But we're also a central location for issues such as pipeline safety, the analytics that go into estimating what is happening in the marketplace. All of those things are things that we do on behalf of our local gas utility members.
You are a lobbying group then, I'm assuming, as well as a trade group?
You'll have to repeat that again. I'm sorry.
Is lobbying part of what goes on at AGA?
Yes, it is. We do have a lobbying group here.
Right, and your title in particular, policy analysis, suggests not just policy within the AGA, but I'm assuming also the national and state policy as well?
Particularly the national analytics is what we look at. State policies, to some extent, when I'm asked to look at them, yes.
Is most of the regulation then does occur at the federal level then, correct?
Well, actually, for local gas utilities, for those utilities that serve the customers in Northern California and in Oregon, those companies' activities are most closely regulated by the states, by the public service commissions. But because bringing energy to consumers is often involving interstate commerce, that is, in the case of natural gas, the gas is produced, say, in the Rocky Mountains and then delivered to Oregon, the federal government does have jurisdiction over the pipeline transportation and a number of the other issues that go with bringing that energy to the customer.
All right, much more to talk about in the mechanics of the operation, but let's just give a thumbnail sketch before we get to a break about this winter versus last winter. You mentioned that the outlook is for potentially somewhat above average temperatures, which would make this a fairly different winter from last year already, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yes, it would. I've seen a number of things written about the polar vortex that we went through, if you will, for much of the country in 2013, 2014. I've seen that there are some expectations that it might repeat itself during the 2014-2015 winter, but the analysts that I have read say that those would be short-term events, not sustained longer-term events. like we had last year. And as I said, if you go to the National Weather Service and look at their long-term prediction maps right now for temperature across the country, the western and northern tier of the country is tending to show above average conditions over the next 3 months and then even out 6 months. The one exception to that is the very southern portion of the country where there are some below temperature indications. So right now, I wouldn't expect a repeat of what we saw last year weather-wise.
All right, we'll talk about how the gas industry fared and how the rest of the industry fared with delivery of fuels for people to stay warm last winter, which got to be a bit of a task at points, as you can understand. Back to talk more with Chris McGill at the American Gas Association about winter heating costs and much more when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about winter heating costs with Chris McGill, Vice President of Policy Analysis at the American Gas Association. He's got facts and figures by the score in front of him about the costs of natural gas and other entities that we use for heating our homes in the winter. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760. Our lone phone number across the region, 800-838-3760, or you can send us an email to jx@jeffnet.org. So, Chris, we've established that this winter, at least in the west and north, looks maybe somewhat above average as far as temperatures go. I'm curious to know what the projections were for last winter, if it accounted for things like if they accounted for things like the polar vortex, and if there might have been a prediction about above average temperatures even last year that turned out to not be true.
Well, actually, that can happen any year. Even the weather predictions that I'm discussing with you now change from month to month. Certainly, the polar vortex specifically, as it occurred for the period of time that it occurred, really throughout the first quarter of 2014, and over the vast geographic area that it occurred in, from the mountain front east, almost the entire United States was under that influence. That was not predicted. Predicting another polar vortex, scientists say that it could happen again, but I don't see that prediction for this year.
All right, let's touch on the costs before we get into the mechanics of gas delivery in the winter, because the costs themselves are interesting. And it looks like, for one thing, I have some figures in front of me from the U.S. Energy Information Agency, and the figures that have you provided as well. And it looks like there's some differences here, some daylight between what they are predicting for increases in gas prices this winter and what you're predicting.
Well, let's separate things here. Gas prices, both of us said that the cost on a unit basis for natural gas was going to be higher this year. That makes a lot of sense. Local gas utilities put gas in storage. They prepare a gas supply plan ahead of time. They did that last winter. They're doing it again this winter. And the cost of gas from last winter to this winter, as we enter it, has gone up slightly. We said about 9%. Gas bills, however, if you include the predictions for what we see as the outlook for the winter weather, are potentially going to be down, according to the Energy Information Administration. Down maybe a couple of percent compared to what they were the year prior. We, on an average basis nationally, also look at the cost of the infrastructure, the delivery structure, getting gas to consumers. We know that has gone up slightly from surveys that we have done, about a percent and a half over last year. With the data that we had a month ago, and again, as I noted, that data changes as you go forward, we thought that we might see a 4-7% increase in bills based principally on those increases in gas costs. But the more moderate the winter is, the less chance there will be for higher bills, frankly, going ahead. So if these expectations for a more moderate winter persist, then customers really may see no change in their bills compared to what they saw last year.
So they'll pay more per unit of gas, but they'll use less gas because it won't be a severe winter.
Yes, sir. That's how it seems to be analytically shaping up right now. Mm-hmm.
All right. And so, there does seem to be quite an abundance of gas, though. So what would be some of the factors that would make the per unit cost higher?
Well, one thing analytically first, going back to 2012, the average cost of a unit, a million BTUs of natural gas at Henry Hub, one of the pricing points we look at, for the year in 2012 was only $2.75. That's very low compared to history. And there was a number of market factors that were influencing that. In 2013, that price rose about a dollar overall to about $3.75 per million BTU on average. And for 2014, the pricing on average during the period of time that I'm talking about, where we put gas in storage and all that, was up over $4 per million BTUs. So analytically, that's what's happened. Now, then why has that happened? I would go back and point out again, the pricing in 2012 for this market, for the types of resources that are being developed, was unsustainable. There were numerous market influences that created that. The $4 per million BTU price that we see today, in my judgment, reflects more closely what it takes to get the gas to market, the technology and everything that is going into producing natural gas today safely and efficiently. And that's principally the unconventional shales, the tight sands in the Mountain West. These are the plays that have added to the resource abundance, but they are very much technology-driven, and they're not free. The technology costs something, and the pricing that we see in the marketplace today, relatively stable compared to history, to me is more reflective of what the real cost of getting that gas out of the ground is.
So you're able to access pockets of gas, plays of gas that you couldn't access before, but they still are somewhat more costly than previous plays to get into.
Yes.
All right. I'm curious, though, about some of the other factors that led to the lower pricing. You talked about $2.75 in 2012, $3.75 in 2013, and up over $4 now. Has there been some promo pricing over the years, some ways to entice people to hook up to natural gas as their heat source that might have played a factor in the rates 2 years ago?
The pricing I just referenced to you is not a delivered cost to consumer.
Right.
It's
okay.
Pricing at Henry Hub, which tends to be a national market balance point. Mm-hmm. Really, it is reflecting on the supply and demand relationship. Supply, starting 3, 4, and even 5 years ago, coming forward to where we are today, was far outstripping the increases in demand that we were seeing. And it really got to a place where the marketplace was flooded with natural gas and demands just hadn't caught up. Demand has increased, however, over the last several years, and it is catching up. There are some other things happening on the policy side that is pushing the use of natural gas. There are consumer decisions being made that natural gas is a fuel of choice, a foundation fuel, if you will. So that supply-demand balance is coming a little more closely together, and that is part of the market action that has pushed natural gas prices up a little bit from where they were 2 years ago.
And when I look at the distribution here, and then now I'm looking at the Energy Information Agency's or Energy Information Administration's numbers for number of households by primary space heating fuel, natural gas is well more than half of the heat source for the American public. We're talking on projected 59 million homes this year heated by natural gas. In second place would be electricity with a hair over 47 million, and the other guys much farther behind.
Oil and propane also. And in some cases, you see conversions between those fuels. In the southern United States, that might be a conversion towards electricity. In other parts of the country, in the West, in the Midwest, even in the Northeast, the general conversion activity often goes towards a value fuel like natural gas and away from some of those other fuels, just because on a day-to-day basis, year-to-year, season-to-season basis, it costs less. Equipment changes also. Efficiencies in equipment change. All of those things add to the consumer decision that is made about whether to convert to a different fuel or to stay with the fuel that you have.
And I see the projections for this winter in particular that we're talking about potentially a modest 0.7% increase in the number of households heated by natural gas, 3.1% up for electricity. But the big losers in this case are heating oil and propane, down each more than 3% in the numbers, the raw numbers of homes anticipated to be heated with that over the course of this winter. So certainly natural gas and electricity picking up what propane and home heating oil are losing.
That has been the general trend, and mostly that's been on the basis of these price comparisons that we were talking about.
Chris McGill is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the Vice President of Policy Analysis at the American Gas Association. We're talking about delivery of winter fuels and particularly delivery of gas and what it costs to heat homes this winter. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760. Send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So the mechanics now, because this is fascinating to me when you talk about how to make a plan for delivery of gas during the winter season. What are some of the things that have to happen? Give us the whole walkthrough, if you would, then, from wellhead to burner at the home and all the different places it has to go and what is done to it.
Well, natural gas is a fungible commodity. It is produced from wells, as you noted. A great deal of drilling activity here in the United States and in Canada. North America is very natural gas rich, very hydrocarbon rich, in fact. Gas is produced from wells that might be producing out of sandstone, limestone, more recently out of shales. And the technology used to get that production to the surface economically, hydraulic fracturing, horizontal drilling, I know, as you are aware, have been in the news.
Quite a bit.
But just to kind of take you through the process then, once that natural gas is produced, and the natural gas can have liquids with it also, the gas is treated, it's gathered, treated, separated. It's put into often interstate pipelines, large volume pipelines, high pressure pipelines, shipped across states or even across the country. It comes to as what we normally describe as a city gate. The local gas utility that serves customers in your areas generally have a franchise in a territory. They have an infrastructure built to receive these gas supplies, and then they step the pressure of that natural gas down, all the way down through their systems to a point where it's delivered to the household. But for a local gas utility, there are some customers that manage this process themselves. They tend to be the larger industrial customers. They might even be a power generator. For the normal person at home, you're depending on your local gas utility to manage those supplies, to acquire those supplies, and get them delivered to your house. With respect to the natural gas molecules themselves, that is a cost to the consumer, is a direct pass-through. You or I pay what the companies pay to acquire those molecules. We also pay, of course, the distribution charge, the charge that goes with getting that gas from the city gate through the distribution system, supporting all of that infrastructure, and getting it to your household. That's where the local gas utility puts its print on this option, this possibility of delivering energy to the home in the form of natural gas.
That's a lot of steps along the way, then.
Yes, it is.
What you mentioned, I know you're talking about the Henry Hub price, which is the cost to just to produce the gas, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So,
well, Henry Hub is a gathering point. Producers in the southeast along the Gulf Coast of the United States drill their wells, produce their gas, and they ship it towards what are called market centers. This is a place where more than one pipeline generally comes together with others, and you do buying and selling there. And that's essentially what Henry Hub is. It happens to be located in Louisiana.
All right. So how is the final price for the consumer arrived at?
Well, you have that commodity charge for any local gas utility then, whether they're in Missouri or in Oregon. They have not only the charge of the cost of the gas at that marketing hub, then you have to pay for the capacity, the transportation cost to get that gas from that hub to your city gate. And so the companies in the Pacific Northwest will not only have contractual arrangements with producers in order to acquire the molecules, but they'll have contractual arrangements for capacity with transportation companies, with pipeline companies, to move those gas volumes to where they need to be when they're needed. And that's year-round. Obviously, for the winter heating season, because that's when most customers use natural gas, at least residential and small commercial customers, the local gas utilities build a portfolio in order to be able to get the right gas supply to their customers when their customers need it.
So are really large tanks maintained someplace to, close to where the final delivery point is to make sure that there is gas nearby for delivery that winter?
Well, tank storage can work, but tank storage is mostly for liquids. So if you're storing a gas commodity in a tank, it's generally compressed natural gas or liquefied natural gas, LNG. We are, here in the United States, the largest producer of natural gas in the world, and we are that producer every single day. So some days, particularly during the summer, when we're not consuming as much, we put gas into storage, and that storage tends to be underground storage. Some of those facilities exist in Oregon, for example. The Mist Field in Oregon is an underground storage facility. Often these fields are old producing fields. They're re-engineered in order to be able to take gas in so it can be stored and then withdraw the gas so it can be added to the gas supplies that are flowing to the city gate, but added closer by to that gas mix to meet the consumer needs during the winter heating season, during the peak period. So the United States is actually, by the way, the largest storage system in the world also. We store or have the capability to store nearly 4 trillion cubic feet of natural gas prior to a winter heating season so it can be used. And that gas, usually on a national basis now, it accounts for somewhere between 18, 19, 20, 21, 22% of all the gas distributed to consumers during a winter heating season. So it's a very important part of what that supply picture can be.
You mentioned the Mist Field in Oregon. Where is that?
Geographically, I don't have a map in front of me. I can't remember exactly. But yes, there is underground storage capacity in Oregon that is utilized by Northwest Natural, for example, and the companies that serve Oregon territories.
Before we go to break, you mentioned that we are the largest producer of natural gas in America. How much has gas production increased in the last 5, 10, 20 years, whatever the most convenient measure is?
Yeah, a decade ago, we were producing, on average in the United States, about 52 billion cubic feet per day of dry natural gas production. That production level today is 69 billion cubic feet per day. So that is significant growth. That's, what is that? About 30%?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
North of that.
So that's this concept, this idea of a strong resource base in America and North America, it is shown in those numbers.
All right. Much more to talk about with Chris McGill, the Vice President of Policy Analysis at the American Gas Association. We're talking about the delivery of gas and cost of gas and other winter fuels as we approach the winter heating season. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Chris McGill and your questions and comments if you'd like to join us. Back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about winter heating costs and what you might pay for heating your home with natural gas, for example, this winter. We have some information about that and other fuels as well from Chris McGill, who is the Vice President of Policy Analysis at the American Gas Association. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can join us with questions or comments at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I want to go a little deeper into some of the challenges that last winter presented when it got as cold as it did in large parts of the country. And I know there's a recent report out from the American Gas Association about the delivery system worked. You basically kept everybody who needed gas in the gas last winter, but it was tough, I'm sure.
Yes, that's a fair statement. As I noted before when we started the program, the polar vortex basically presented the most challenging situation that we've seen in this country in a long, long time. And it's not only just that temperatures were cold, but they were sustained. January was the largest consuming month for natural gas nationally than had ever occurred before. It was the record month. And then February followed it with a record February. And then March followed it with a record March. So the demands on the system and some of the things that we've talked about already, the flowing supply in the gas pipelines, the utilization of storage, all of these things are orchestrated together to meet a peak day. That's what local gas utilities do in terms of their planning. But you don't expect your peak day to necessarily happen again and then again and then again and then again. And in some places in the country, you had companies with 5 or even 10 or 15 of their strongest demand days ever occurring in one winter. So it was an extraordinary test of the system in general.
So given what you've explained already about the delivery mechanisms involved in getting natural gas from well to somebody's pilot light and then obviously to the main burner, what do the utilities do, the gas utilities do, to prepare for downturns? I mean, what kinds of things do you just do to make sure that the supply is there, that gas is available when people seek it out?
Well, when you look at our reporting, it does cover those two very general areas. And in fact, it covers two general areas, one in which you're referring to, Jeffrey, the supply side. But there is the demand and the efficiency side of things, too. So let's talk about both of those very quickly. On the demand and efficiency side, overall, residential customers, small commercial customers, have been about 2% more efficient year over year over year for the past 10 years. That happens because people winterize their homes better, they have better windows, they insulate more. The equipment that they exchange today, heaters for homes, even a gas dryer, a water heater, they're all more efficient than they used to be. So all of those things have helped on the efficiency side. On the supply side, a local gas utility works virtually year-round to predict, anticipate, and to build a supply portfolio. They contract with producers of natural gas. They contract with the pipelines to create the capacity they're going to need during these critical times. They use resources such as storage, the underground storage that I was speaking of that often has to be delivered via pipeline. But even local gas utilities can have propane air injection facilities for very, very peak periods or liquefied natural gas injection facilities for very peak periods also to maintain their system integrity. So just to give you a sense of how this shifts and changes and what your local gas utility is doing, this past winter heating season that we experienced, January 7th of 2014, 139 billion cubic feet of natural gas was consumed across the country, a record day for natural gas consumption. During the middle of the summer, when natural gas is going to other things, but certainly not to heating, you can have a consumption day that's below 50 billion cubic feet. So you have a swing over the course of a year from the 50 or the low 50s billion cubic feet per day of natural gas consumption to a day that can be over 130 BCF. That's what your local gas utility does. That managing those swings, having the gas available for customers at that critical time is what they do.
Not terribly different from the electrical system where you have to anticipate demand well enough to have the supply available all the time, right there at the same level.
True. The one difference with gas, we touched on it before, was in general, electricity cannot be stored, but natural gas can be stored. And that's one of its advantages in terms of the economics of having that gas supply available for customers.
When we start talking deep freezes like the polar vortex of last winter, do there become physical challenges with gas delivery? I can recall, and it's been probably since the late 80s or early 90s, hearing about parts of the Midwest where things got so cold that people's natural gas was turning to jelly. I don't know if that was talking about CNG, LNG, propane, what?
I didn't hear about anything like that this year. Now, freeze-offs do occur at wells periodically. When you have a fluid or gas stream coming through a wellhead, and it's changing pressure as it comes through the wellhead, and you have extremely cold temperatures, you can get condensation in the valves and on the wellheads and things like that, and you can actually freeze off your production. That does happen periodically. It happened a little bit last year. Now, on the more downstream areas, there are things that can, you know, liquids can fall out, things like that can happen. But for this past winter heating season, maybe we didn't ask the right questions in the winter heating season review that we do, or I just didn't read the right things, but I don't remember that being a major problem. What was a difficulty in the Midwest, again, going back to the storage component, for example, is that those drawdowns on storage that started in December and then January, February, and March were very taxing on the facilities. They just didn't stop. The requirement was there day after day. There are ways in which companies, local gas utilities or pipelines, issue critical days, or they issue operational flow orders, which in a region means you're not going to get your gas supply because of some system integrity issue. So the company has to go somewhere else and look for it. And that happened in the Midwest during the 2013-2014 winter heating season. And then the other thing you always hear a lot about is the Northeast and the amount of gas that goes to power generation in the Northeast, that the pipeline capacity gets constrained based on those requirements. Because, as we know now, we have peaks for electric demand in the middle of the winter, just as we have peaks for gas demand. So those infrastructure things have to work themselves out.
Essentially, infrastructure does have to be built for the days like you were talking about last January 7th. You can't afford to build the infrastructure that's just fine on November 7th and hope you can get through. You have to build it for its maximum use and then be prepared to deliver at that maximum level, but not often, obviously.
Yeah, and that's part of the balance. The market sends you signals. It tells you where capacity is constrained. It tells you where more gas is needed. But it doesn't make sense to utterly overbuild things either, because those peak days only occur on certain days. That's why having market area storage or storage that a local gas utility owns, or inside the gate, if you will, liquefied natural gas or propane air that helps meet those very needle peak periods, is part of the whole supply picture. So as you pointed out, it's relatively complex. That's what the local gas utility does, is it manages all those pieces to make sure that they work efficiently and work affordably for the consumers.
Chris McGill, we have a couple of emails for you here. The first from Stan in Ashland. He writes, natural gas, in quotes, sounds so warm and green, but in fact it's a marketing term for methane, and methane is a worse global warming gas than carbon dioxide. Production, in quotes, is another slippery word. In fact, only nature produces oil and gas. Corporations extract it from the earth. So to point one, when we say natural gas, do we mean methane?
Yes. For natural gas that goes through the pipeline system, well over 90% of what's represented there is methane. Yes.
And methane and carbon dioxide, how do they compare as greenhouse gases?
Well, in terms of the gentleman's comments, yes, methane is a more potent greenhouse gas in the short term. Carbon dioxide has some longer term impacts. They are both greenhouse gases. The Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, measures the amount of methane being discharged from the whole natural gas value chain every year. In fact, as infrastructure has been added, as production has increased, methane emissions, according to EPA, have actually decreased. The companies that I represent, the local gas utilities, view a methane emission as a safety issue, of course. You know, we are working to modernize and upgrade our systems continuously. The trajectory for methane emissions associated with distribution of gas to homes and businesses is unequivocally declining. That doesn't mean that it shouldn't decline more or that methane isn't a greenhouse gas emission, greenhouse gas. All of those things are true. Our companies are incentivized, particularly from a safety standpoint, to limit those as much as they possibly can. On the producing end, producers are also incentivized, in this case, perhaps even more from an economic standpoint. The gas that you capture is gas that you can sell. And again, emissions associated with the production or the extraction of natural gas at the wellhead have been declining also. So I'm a citizen too. I agree with the environmental points that the gentleman has made. The natural gas industry does not sit on its hands with respect to this. It matters that methane emissions are limited for as many reasons as you can possibly give. And frankly, that's the direction that the natural gas value chain is going.
I'm curious about that. What you just said, though, about the difference in long-term and short-term impacts between methane and carbon dioxide.
Well, I'm not a climate scientist. I'm a geologist. Methane goes into the atmosphere. It is reactive. Carbon dioxide goes into the atmosphere. The properties of each of those is slightly different, so they linger in the atmosphere shorter or longer, depending on what the molecule is and what they're mixing with. So I'm really not the person to give you much more detail than that.
Okay, we'll hit you up for a geology question in just a moment, but I want to get in an email here from Mike in Medford. He says, in 2012, Jackson County did a study in using biodigesters to produce methane and electricity from our food waste. Is this still being considered? And I know you represent gas utilities across the country, but do you know of any experiments like that going on?
Well, yeah, actually, I know in the Northeast with several of our companies, biogas is a part of their supply mix, that digesters are in place and that they are being utilized. Certainly in agriculture applications, being able to use whether it's dairy cattle waste or really there's a number of different processes that you can use in the digesters, and you can create a methane type gas which then can drive a generator for electricity. You can, you know, in some cases be self-sufficient or even sell back to the grid. So those possibilities, those options are out there. People look at them. They use them. They're being implemented today.
Okay, so now to the geology question, and we'll get into your zone of expertise here. Based on what we know about the gas plays and resources underneath us, how much longer will the gas boom last? Have we gotten to peak gas or anything like that?
My simple answer to that is no, not to peak gas. If you look at a resource such as the Potential Gas Committee out of the Colorado School of Mines, which has been looking at the gas resource base in this country for 50 years and evaluating it, the Energy Information Administration looks at known reserves. The PGC estimates resources. Those resources have been growing to a point now where when you look at the resources, you think about having 100 years of natural gas supply. But that's been growing, so it could even be more, quite frankly.
All right, we've learned a lot. The biggest thing we've learned is that we might pay more per unit of gas this winter, but potentially use fewer units based on long-range forecasts, which, of course, could change. Chris McGill is Vice President of Policy Analysis at the American Gas Association. Thanks so much for joining us, Chris.
Very, very, very welcome, and glad to be with you.